Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Denise Higgins will be telling us a little bit about her experience with AKU. So, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with AKU?
Sure. I was diagnosed as an infant in those days in 1954 when I was born. There weren't any disposable diapers, so they were all cloth diapers. And my mother was a little alarmed when, upon standing, the diaper would turn black. And so they took me to the Naval Hospital in Norfolk, Virginia, and they amazingly, for that time, diagnosed it correctly, but they didn't know much more about it. They said, oh, she'll probably have tummy aches as she's growing up, but that's about it. So that was all they said to me at the beginning, to my mom.
So, in that sense, how has society progressed in its understanding? What do we know the symptoms to be today?
Well, the symptoms are still pretty similar. The urine will turn dark even in a toilet if it's left to stand. There's an easy test if you suspect you might have alkaptonuria, AKU. You can just add a couple of drops of bleach to your urine and it will immediately turn dark. And so that's probably the easiest way still. They'll do a urinalysis to check that, but then there are also mass spectrophotometry that's done to actually look at more details of what's going on. But other than that, there really is no indication when you're young that there's anything at all going on, which is one reason why the AKU Society of North America is trying to get the AKU test put into all of the birth standard testing so that it's picked up immediately.
So, aside from the urine turning dark, what are some of the impacts of having AKU?
Well, I didn't really notice anything different other than I've got some roughness on the insides of my fingers, almost like calluses, and then dark blue or black dots that showed up there, some blueness in my ears, even my sweat was black, and that was just annoying as I was growing up, a teenager and a young adult. It wasn't until really mid to late 30s when I started noticing a difference in being able to run. I was on a softball league and suddenly it felt like I was running through underwater from home base to first base after hitting the ball and just couldn't go anywhere. And that was an odd thing for me because I played racquetball and softball and bowling and had never had those activities impaired by AKU and didn't even understand that there would be some sort of impairment that would be involved.
So, How did you go about coping with that once you discovered the impairment?
Well, I have worked with scientists and actually have a biotechnology company now, so I immediately went on to PubMed and started looking for any scientific research articles that would tell me more about AKU and what I should know about it. Because here I was in my mid-30s thinking that nothing really was going to come of this strange, rare disease. It's a recessive disease, so it's a gene that's recessive in both parents. So that's why it's so rare. Basically, I found out that because of this genetic problem, homocysteine acid, HGA, is produced, and that just wears away your cartilage, turns your bones black, and so there was, grating in my knee joints. I could hear the bones moving against each other. And so I found a history trial of AKU at the National Institutes of Health, and they were seeing AKU patients from all over the world and taking down a history of where they were, how much joint damage or joint replacements they had had, any change in bone density, looked at heart issues because it can cause a thickening in the aortic valve as well. Checked my eyes on a regular basis. Some people actually have dark dots in their eyes. I don't have that. And then discovered that a drug called nitisinone, which is used to treat tyrosinemia, which is a very serious disease in children, also worked in eliminating HGA, and that's the big problem, child, of AKU, is that if you're continuing to produce this HGA, it turns your bones black, it gets rid of all your cartilage. I've lost over 2 inches in height just because of the lack of cartilage in my spine. And the pain, as you can imagine, was pretty big. And so part of the history trial at the NIH was going to pain management and figuring out what was going to help with that. It turned out that the nitisinone not only stopped the HGA production, but within, I'd say 4 to 6 weeks, there was very little pain. I was taking nothing other than naproxen before I would go and play golf, and that was all.
So, what would you say to society in terms of a message about the need to keep pushing forward with the research and the testing you alluded to from the society?
Well, the most important thing is to know early that you have it. They're doing some wonderful work in the United Kingdom on testing for nitisinone and doing pediatric studies too, because the idea is for someone like me, when I already had joint damage, it's not going to reverse it. It stops it because it doesn't keep going on, but you already have impairment. So both of my knees are replaced, one of my hips is replaced, and many people have multiple other joint shoulders replaced. If you can get on a drug or have some sort of a gene transfer treatment, which is still in the research stages, but nitisinone itself will stop those things from happening in the first place. So that gives great hope for teenagers, young adults who really haven't noticed any physical differences or changes yet, that if they start taking it and stop the production of homocysteine acid, they won't have those problems in the future. So it's not a cure, but it's something that, while they're looking for a cure, will greatly improve the quality of life of young people who will not have to have all those joint replacements.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, our friend Nama Weingarten will be sharing a little bit of her insight into the whole reporting of the latest wave of the pandemic. In this segment of our show, our friend Nama Weingarten will be sharing some of her insights into reporting on marginalized communities, including the disability community. So, with the recent upsurge in COVID cases, since I've had you on before to talk about some of the effects that it has on the community, what have you seen with this latest wave?
It's crazy, you know, during every wave, there's always this surge of people I know texting me that they're scared that they have corona. But I have to say, out of all the waves, this has to be the peak. Like, quite literally, almost all of my friends have had, like, some kind of COVID scare. A person that they know who has tested positive. Like, it's crazy. I actually have never known so many people who have COVID at the same time. So it's a wild time. It's a wild time. You know, there's just, it's funny because just a couple weeks ago, it didn't even seem like this variant was going to be that big. I remember seeing like one headline on Twitter, oh, new variant discovered in, you know, South Africa, and me thinking, oh, I sure hope that doesn't blow up and look at where we are now. But I think we all had a sense that like we were finally going to get a normal Christmas, finally going to get a normal New Year's where we get to move on. You know, cases were down for so long. And then all of a sudden, they started going up again, you know, and all these fears that we haven't had in months start creeping back, you know, and all of a sudden, like what Doug Ford was talking about, you know, removing vaccine mandates completely in January, right? Like, if anything, they're worsening restrictions now. So I think it's just really annoying to see this happen. I think unlike the first wave back in March 2020, where it was kind of like, oh my God, what is this? We don't know what this is, and the initial freakout. It's kind of more of like, at least I speak for myself, I'm not freaking out anymore. I'm just kind of done. I'm just exhausted, and I'm tired, and I'm burnt out. And I almost wish I was freaking out, because maybe that's a more entertaining feeling to have than sheer boredom. And yeah, that's kind of how I feel.
So, you bring up an interesting point about all the fears and the paranoia, if you will, about those who do have it versus those who are afraid of getting it. I'd imagine there's going to be something of a long-term mental health impact in terms of these fears and anxieties aren't just going to go away overnight, even if the virus does.
Absolutely, I agree with you. Yeah, this is something we're going to be stuck with. Because, I mean, even after the pandemic is over, COVID is always going to be here, you know, just like we get yearly flu shots, you know, and just like kids get HIV shots and all that kind of stuff, you know, we have all these terrible viruses that circulate in our society, but we have good vaccines that combat these viruses, and people get those vaccines, but guess what, life moves on, and you know, in 20 years from now, yeah, my kid might come home from school with COVID, but at least, you know, the schools are not going to shut down because of it. It's always going to be a part of our lives. But I agree with you. Like, I think people will always have that fear. I think some people. I think it depends on how you look at it to a certain extent, right? Like, some people have a privilege of not having to be scared. And I think that's also something that needs to be addressed. Like, a lot of people, especially young people, are like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to go party as much as I want. I'm just going to do this. If I catch it, I catch it. Who cares? You know, like, maybe they're financially stable enough to be able to live alone without their parents or grandparents. You know, they're healthy, so they're lucky in that sense. But not everyone has that privilege, right? There's a lot of people who are immunocompromised and, like, already have disabilities. And we know the effects that long COVID could have, you know, where the effects of COVID persist for months on end and the effects that it can have. So a lot of people don't have the luxury to just be chill about this virus. You know, like a lot of people have conditions and a lot of people live with their grandparents or older adults. A lot of people have loved ones in long-term care homes and they cannot afford to get them sick. So, you know, I think it's really like the luxury of being scared and not being scared really depends on your life and your circumstances, right? So I think on certain people, it'll definitely have much more mental health impacts than others.
That being said, it may also depend on how COVID impacted you. If you're someone who, say, lost a loved one in the middle of all this, the impact of that, that's always going to stay with you.
Absolutely. It's always going to stay with you, yeah. Like, there's some people who, for them, this whole situation, and it's a good point, Cam, like, because there's some people who, to them, this whole situation is like, it's just a virus. It's just a virus that's preventing me from going out, and I have to work at home, and it's annoying, da-da-da-da-da. But for some, it's much bigger than that, right? They lost loved ones to this. Now they're, along with dealing with the pandemic, they're also dealing with a terrible amount of grief. And there's people who lost their entire businesses to this. So many restaurants closed down. Entertainment venues? Oh my God. So many closed down. Bars? It's awful. You know? And all these people, not only do they have to deal with the isolation of the pandemic, but they also have to deal with losing their job and dealing with debt and financial burdens that they don't always have support with, right? So it's definitely worse for some people than others, and the effects of it will last. Imagine you're a family that had a family-owned restaurant for the past 30 years, and that was your income, that was your livelihood, and boom, that restaurant is just gone now. Like, even if the pandemic goes away, you know, you can't, your life won't be back to what it was, and I think that's also something to grieve for.
So, as a reporter yourself, you've talked a lot about reporting on marginalized groups. How have you found the mental health coverage of the effects of the pandemic to be? Do you think there's enough representation, or is it just we're focusing on the virus, not the side effects?
Oh my God, the representation has been awful, Cam. Like, I think it's less about focusing on the virus, but it's all about who are we focusing on. Like, when we talk, for example, about essential workers, who are most often low-income citizens, when we talk about these essential workers who, you know, bag our groceries and ship our Amazon packages, like, when you see interviews up on TV, I swear, it's literally all you hear from is business owners. The owner of this restaurant, the owner of this grocery store, the president of this business association. Who cares? You know what I mean? Like, who cares what they think? None of these people are on the ground. None of these people are risking their lives every single day for minimum wage. Like, let me hear from the actual, you know what I mean? Let me hear from the actual people on the ground who are having to, like, go through this. But we don't really get those perspectives, you know? Like, I don't think throughout this entire pandemic, I've seen a single interview with, like, a grocery store worker who says, yeah, you know, we've had an outbreak. Yeah, I've gotten sick. Yeah, this is what it's like. I would like to see interviews with janitors, you know, or even when it comes to the disabled community. Like, all the interviews I'm seeing with the disabled community is like, oh, you know, the minister of this affairs, and, you know, this ministry of da-da-da, and this expert on da-da-da-da-da. Like, why don't you bring me, like, an actual person with disability who, you know, has been taken care of, maybe at a long-term care home, or maybe at any kind of, like, institution, and show me what the pandemic has done on them. Maybe show me an essential worker, right, that has, like, that is immunocompromised, and tell me their story about maybe they're scared to go to work every day, but they have to keep going to work because they need to put food on the table. Like, these are the kind of stories that I want to see in a newspaper, on the media, but we're not getting these stories. Instead, we're getting, like, what business association owner thinks. You know what I mean? And it's just, it's so tone-deaf to the situation that we're in. And I think, to me, it just shows that all these big legacy media publications who are choosing to interview these kinds of people, you know, it just shows who they think their viewers are. And I think they're really wrong.
That being said, ignorance is its own disability.
Absolutely. I'd
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Well, thank you.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Denise Higgins told us a little bit about AKU, and our friend, Alma Weingarten, gave us an update on reporting on the pandemic and some of the mental health impacts therein. In this segment of our show, Deborah Muzakar will be telling us a little bit about the art of autism. So, can you tell me a little bit about your autism work?
Well, we have a nonprofit. It's the Art of Autism, and we've been a nonprofit for approximately 5 years. Before that, we still had the Art of Autism for maybe over a decade. And we decided to become a nonprofit 5 years ago because our project had expanded in such a way that we were involving people around the world, and it was a big project. On our board, we half of our board members are on the autism spectrum. We're unique in that way. We have about 9 board members, and 5 of them are on the autism spectrum.
So, in terms of programs and services, what do you offer to the community?
We do mostly projects. We have Women's History Month, where we have an art contest of people that influence them, women that influence them in history. We have Poetry and Arts for Peace. We have partnered with numerous colleges around the world, even in the UK, to do projects. We have partnered with Apple to do created on an iPad series where autistic people use an iPad that Apple gives them to create art. We've done museum exhibits, gallery exhibits, and a lot of projects.
So when it comes to someone with autism creating art, I'd imagine there's sort of a calming and soothing impact of that.
Yes. Art helps people process, you know, emotions and to organize themselves sometimes.
So, how do you reach out to the community to let them know about the projects that you're doing?
How do we reach out to the community?
Yes.
We do it through our website. We've had over 6 million views on our website. Through social media, through, you know, YouTube videos, through our newsletter, and through press releases.
So, in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about art and autism?
There are a lot of misperceptions. One is that people on the autism spectrum are rote, and they do not have creativity and cannot create things from within themselves, and that's not true. Another is that they all think literally, and they cannot create abstract art, and that's not true. One is that they cannot express emotions, and so their art does not have an emotional impact. There are a lot of misperceptions.
So, how does the art that your artists create defy these myths?
Well, a lot of the art is, like, for example, very emotional or impactful or expresses emotional content. And so that art defies that myth. The other is about abstract art that many of them are great abstract artists and see. For example, we have one artist, Jeremy Sisselkira, that sees emotions as colors, and that's an abstract concept. And synesthesia is a common thing with some of our artists. That is where a crossover of senses where, for example, like Jeremy, they'll see emotions as colors or numbers as representation of some attribute.
So, in your time with the Arts of Autism, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Well, last year we were at the Oceanside Museum of Art for a 3-month exhibit, and that's in California. It was a really nice exhibit. That being in museums is, we've been in several museums, is really a standout. We were also at the California Museum with a collaborative exhibit, but we had our own exhibit at the Oceanside Museum of Art, and I thought that was a really great acknowledgement of that our art belongs in museums.
So, in terms of the artists themselves, do you use any modified teaching techniques or equipment?
We don't personally teach artists art. Sometimes we've had like workshops, but we don't necessarily do that. We're primarily a vehicle for artists to display their art to, it could be poetry, it could be the written word, it could be all kinds of things. It's through our website and through our events.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for 2022 that you'd like the community to know about?
Well, we have an art song project where we're collaborating with Central Washington University, where the students in the class have looked at our website and have been inspired by some of the art and are creating original musical compositions to that art. Last year they did poetry, and this year they're doing the art. We also have a couple exhibits. We're in downtown San Diego for a play, The Curious Incident of the Dog at Night. We have an art exhibit there. And we also have an art exhibit in February for Valentine's Day about your true colors, and that's in Escondido, California. So those are, and we'll also be at San Diego Festival of the Arts in the fall. That will be the second year we participated in that. We have ongoing events all the time. And we have Women's History Month, which is March. We're accepting art right now for that.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for inclusion in the arts, what would you say?
I think we all learn from each other, and that it's necessary to have all kinds of people participating in the arts. And the arts is a great field for someone on the autism spectrum, because artists just tend to be less judgmental and, you know, inclusive of different types of techniques and different ways of creating art. For example, we have one artist that she has problems with controlling her hand movements, and she does a dabbing technique to create her art. It's just a more inclusive environment.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
It always amazes me, my friends, the human capacity to cope with what seems to be an intractable or impossible situation. Take this past year, actually, these past 2 years at this point, the pandemic. People have been forced, quite literally, rebuild their lives. Take circumstances they've never known how to deal with before, and to try to make the best of it. Some have had, as Nama described, somewhat easier time with that. Others have had to adapt to a new normal. In disability life, being flexible and being open to those adaptations is an everyday thing. Taking the tools you've been given, circumstances before you, learning how to work with them. Sometimes it doesn't appear on first glance that you're making a lot of headway. But if you look beyond the surface, if you look at the steps being taken in the right direction, you will find that a person with a disability is moving forward. They are creating, living, making the world a better place, even if it's just in their own way. Fact is, we all can take a page out of these past 2 years and ask ourselves, are we really so limited by our fears and our doubts and our hesitations? Or, like those with disabilities who live with dignity and strength every day, can we take the circumstance, create something better? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.